You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Well, we left off in chapter 2 last week, and we studied that Moses' life was on a very good trajectory, you might say. He's rich, handsome, educated, and powerful. He's right in the crux of everything that's happening in the geopolitical scene in Egypt. So the first-time reader might assume that this is how God's plan is going to unfold, that just like Joseph being the second-in-command to Pharaoh, so too what we're seeing is that God has placed Moses directly in the center of Egypt, and he's going to work politically through the person of Moses. Let's read. We read in chapter 2, verse 11, "One day after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were, and he watched them at their hard labor." According to Acts chapter 7, he's 40 years old at this point. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Moses' mother had taught him as a young boy that he was in fact a Hebrew. She weaned him and then gave him over to the daughter of the Pharaoh, so he knew he was Jewish. He sees one of his fellow Hebrews being beaten by an Egyptian. What are you supposed to do while looking this way and looking that way and seeing no one around? He killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. Whoa, 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 whoa. So Moses is thinking, all right, you know, my soul is just vexed with anger. I've got to do something. What do? Go kill a guy. That's what he does. Immediate failure. For one, this is immoral. Thou shalt not kill. Of course, we have due process. They had it back then. You can't just see somebody doing something wrong and take things into your hands and have them killed. Even a slave owner, you can't do that. And what's with the looking this way and that way, hiding the body? That shows that Moses was having a moment of conscience. He knew something was wrong. This is an outright outrageous sin. Moreover, it's not just sinful, it's stupid. Think about that. What kind of a plan is this anyways? So, what are you going to do, Moses? Well, I'm going to take down the greatest empire known to man. All right, what's your first step? I'm going to kill a guy, and I'm going to bury him in the sand. And then what? I don't know. I'm just doing this step by step here, okay? I don't know what's going to happen next. Totally ineffective. And this is based on self-effort. He didn't consult with God. God isn't even in the picture. He won't show up until chapter 3. As one Bible teacher put it, when Moses tries to overthrow Egypt, he's only able to bury one Egyptian in the sand. When God is prepared, he's able to bury the entire army. And so God, moving, is far greater than Moses. Moses had the right desire, but he had the wrong method, he had the wrong timing. Everything was wrong here. The next day, he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting. So he asked the one in the wrong, "Why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew?" So you get this impression Moses is like, "Hi, I'm Moses. I'm here to rescue you. I just killed one of the Egyptians yesterday, and I want to adjudicate this fight that you're having." And immediately this guy turns back and looks at Moses. The man said, "Who made you ruler and judge over us?" Think about that for a second. Let me repeat that. Who made you ruler and judge over us? This statement is pregnant with irony. Who indeed? God didn't make Moses the ruler. Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian? So the cat is out of the bag. And Moses was afraid, and he thought, what I did must have become known. Then Pharaoh hears about this. He tries to kill Moses, but Moses runs for his life from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well. How did the news spread so fast? It's like, kills him the next day. There's already rumors about this. And then it's on the front page of the Egyptian Times. Pharaoh knows about it. Bring me Moses' head. Well, for one, it's hard to hide a murder in ancient Egypt. This isn't like a modern metropolis. Also, have you ever buried a corpse in the sand? Like, have you ever killed a guy, like clubbed him to death and then dug the grave in the sand in the middle of Egypt in the hot sun? Have you ever done that? I never have, okay, but I imagine it smells atrocious. His body was decomposing out in the middle of the Egyptian sun in the sand in a shallow grave. They found this. And one of these taskmasters goes missing. You think he wasn't noticed? And so the Egyptian police presumably come in. They're saying, who's responsible? The Hebrews had the motive. And the Hebrews must have said, him. We saw it. They ratted him out. They didn't want to face the heat. This would have come down very hard on the Hebrew slaves. So he flees all the way to Midian. Now, a priest of Midian, verse 16, had 7 daughters, and they came to draw water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. Some shepherds, you know, those menacing Midianite shepherds, they show up and they drove them all away. But Moses got up and came to their rescue and watered the flock. Moses, at this point, is 40. He just killed a guy. Seems like he's pretty tough at this point. This pack of shepherds shows up and he fights them off. Then he waters the flock. That was the work of 7 women. And he gets this done before quitting time that day. Well, the girls go home, return to Reuel, their father. And Reuel, the father, he asks them, why have you returned so early today? They answered, you know, an Egyptian rescued us from these shepherds. He even drew water for us. And then he watered our flocks. Where is he? Reuel asked his daughters. Why did you leave him outside? Invite him in here to get something to eat. And so Moses accepted the invitation and he settled there with Reuel and the 7 daughters. I'm sure you can see where this is headed. 1 Moses, 7 Reuel daughters. In time, Reuel gave Moses his daughter Zipporah to be his wife. And later, Zipporah and Moses gave birth to a son. And Moses named him Gershom, for he explained, I have been a foreigner in a foreign land. Gershom, in the Hebrew ger, meaning a foreigner, an alien. And Shom, meaning there, foreigner there. What are you going to name your boy, Moses? He's a foreigner over there, no longer in Egypt, just a foreigner near the well in Midian. To think about that, to go from riches to rags, to be in the center of Egypt, and then to run for your life somewhere out here, somewhere in Midian. We're not precisely sure where Midian is. Why? Because the Midianites were a nomadic people. They were distant cousins of the Hebrews through Abraham, through his second wife, Keturah, Genesis 23. But they took off in a different direction and they would just pick up and move. So we're not exactly sure if this even is the territory or whether it was in the Sinai Peninsula. But here we have the great Moses overnight going from the inner sanctum of Pharaoh's court down to being near a well in Midian. What must he have been thinking? I thought I was in God's will. I thought that. But I'm just too sinful. I killed a man. Could you imagine the guilt, the feelings that would just be banging around your head? To have killed a man, to move the body, to throw it in a grave, and to deal with the public guilt. He'd be thinking, I'm too incompetent. What was I thinking? Why would I just kill one of the slave masters? I didn't have a plan. You know, I thought I was some kind of an educated, respected leader, but I'm not. In fact, it only took me a day before that just all went right down the toilet. Now I'm too old. Moses is not getting any younger at this point. In fact, we're going to see that 4 decades pass until God intervenes into his life. He will be 80 years old at this point. 80 years old before you start your ministry for Christ. Yeah, that's too old. You cannot start at that age. You're done. It's over. To be publicly humiliated, to have not only the Egyptians, these people with whom you had a close relationship, but also the Hebrews, the people whom you were trying to save, all of them have seen you as a public spectacle, and to actually try and take a step out for God, feeling a desire in your heart to do something, and then to totally fail publicly. Okay, it's too late. It's over. You know, God might use somebody else, maybe, but I know for sure you don't go from the palace to the prairie, chasing sheep around in the desert, and then that's where God calls you. However, what God was trying to teach Moses at this point was that there was another greater deliverer than Moses, the people. See, at this point, Moses thought that he was the deliverer, and God wanted to teach him differently. That's why we read in verse 23, during that long period the king of Egypt had died, the Israelites groaned in their slavery, and their cry, that is their prayer, went up to God. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned for them. Here, God enters the narrative powerfully. This gives a sense of anticipation for what he's about to do. And as I said, 40 years pass. According to Exodus chapter 7, verse 7, Moses is now 80 years old, and he wakes up that morning the way he woke up every morning as an 80-year-old man, probably his body hurting, chasing the sheep around the desert, thinking this was going to be a day just like any other. Boy, was he wrong. We read in chapter 3, now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law. He led the flock to the far side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There, the angel of the Lord, this is God himself, angel meaning a messenger in Hebrew, Malak, is a messenger of God, not speaking of his essence, but speaking of his function, speaking for God, as God, as we learn later. The angel of the Lord appeared to Moses in flames of fire from within a bush. Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought to himself, I will go over and see this strange sight, why the bush does not burn up. So much for the idea that these ancient people were pre-scientific and they wouldn't know a miracle versus a scientific law if it hit them in the face. Now, Moses knew enough about combustion and he knew enough about chemistry that bushes don't burn without turning into ash. So he says, something's wrong here. So he goes over to investigate this burning bush. And when the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush. Moses, this is a double vocative, a call, double call. This is a sign of endearment. Moses, I'm here, Moses said. Do not come any closer. Wait a minute. First he's saying this, Moses, and now he's saying this, don't come any closer. Okay, why? He says, take off your sandals. We're in the desert. Okay, I saw, a sheep relieving himself on that bush yesterday, right? Okay, well, what's the problem here? He says, well, take off your sandals. Why? Because I wasn't here yesterday. The place where you're standing is holy ground. You know what that's saying? Wherever God is, that is the holy place. Not in a temple or in a tabernacle, not in a church, not in a sanctuary. It's wherever God is, that's a holy place. So take off your sandals when you come into my presence. Then he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And at this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. The great Moses coming into the presence of God, you would expect as postmodern people that he would go up and give God a big hug, A high five? Just like a Downy commercial where you get that nice, warm, quilty blanket and you hug it and it's nice and warm and fuzzy and soft and it feels so good. You know what I mean? Isn't that how people think about God? He's just so loving and he's lovey-dovey. And not according to Moses. When he comes into contact with the transcendent God, he's afraid. Why? Because he knows that God is holy, distinct, and completely other. And he is sinful. How does a sinful person come into the presence of a holy, morally flawless God? We read in John chapter 1, verse 17, that the law was brought through Moses, but grace and truth was brought through Jesus Christ. Jesus brought us to God, the Father. How? Through his death. That's how. So now, should we fear God? Of course we should fear God. That's a terrifying idea to come into the presence of God. He's seen everything we've ever done. He's a perfect judge. So what does that mean? Well, I'm a perfect person. I've never heard somebody say that. I'm a perfect person. You've committed moral violations, have you not? Well, what do we do with people that commit moral violations? Well, they should be punished. And God has seen them all. He's seen everything you've done in thought, word, and deed. And coming into his presence is a terrifying prospect. Yet, because of the work of Christ, standing in our place for our sins, he took on the punishment so that we can come into his presence. As the author of Hebrews says, boldly coming into the presence of God. Oh, thank God that he intervened so that we no longer have to fear him in this way. Well, the Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I've heard them crying out because of their slave drivers. I'm concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey. Oh, these are the best words to speak to a nomad, aren't they? Moses has been chasing sheep around the desert. And now he's like, I'm going to take you and your people to a land, and it's going to be flowing with milk and honey. It's going to be beautiful. And I'm going to go get those Egyptians. I'm going to rescue them. And Moses is probably thinking to himself, go get them, Lord. Yeah. Get those Egyptians, get Pharaoh. And then right as he's thinking that, God says, so now go. I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. Wait, hold on a second, back up. God, you said that you were going to go rescue the people. Now you're saying I'm going to go rescue the people. Which one? And God says, yes. Yeah, I'm going to do the rescuing, but I'm sending you to go speak to the Pharaoh. What's Moses' first response to this? You know, we might imagine Moses saying, God, do you have any idea how powerful that Pharaoh is? I mean, I ran as fast as I could to get away from him. That's how scary he is. Or, have you seen his army? Have you seen the chariots? I mean, the swords, the Egyptian swords that had that huge curve. I mean, these were the tactical nukes of the day. And God, have you seen the bows and arrows that they have? I mean, have you seen the army? God, I'm still a wanted man. My face is up at the post office in Egypt as we speak. You're going to send me right back in there? I'm too old. And I already failed. I already tried all this. It's your turn. You go do it. I'll just tag along out here and let me know when the cover is clear, and then I'll come in and maybe I can follow you into the promised land. Instead, what we see is that Moses gives a series of excuses that are way different than that. His first excuse doesn't deal with Pharaoh or the army or the danger. It all deals with me, myself, and I. His first excuse is this: who am I? He says in verse 11, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? Of all the excuses, why is this the first one? Any ideas? It seems to me that the comment from the Hebrew from 40 years earlier is still ringing in Moses' head. Who made you ruler and judge over us? Who are you? In other words, yes? Who are you to be the ruler and the judge to liberate us? That thought had been bothering Moses for 4 decades, for half of his life. And now God is saying, I want you to go in there as the ruler and judge. And he's saying, who am I? And he's still being held captive by a comment from a Hebrew from 40 years ago. How does God respond and nurture this man? He doesn't say, you know, Moses, you're a really good-looking man. You're a beautiful boy. Oh, they used to talk about you all the time. He doesn't say that. He doesn't say, you know, you're intelligent. Oh, you're so smart. Oh, you're such a smart and educated. Oh, you're so educated, too. And that's all true, isn't it? Or you used to be Egyptian royalty, Moses. I mean, you speak the Egyptian language. You're the only literate person out of all the Hebrews. Who else am I? I need you, buddy. Come on, get into the game. He doesn't do any of this. Who am I? Who are you? God says, ditto. Who am I? Who am I? I will be with you. He doesn't address anything about Moses. He says nothing about Moses. Instead, he says, I will be with you. That's his answer to Moses' question. This will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship me on this mountain. This happens in 3 months. Well, excuse number two. Well, okay, who am I didn't work? Well, I guess then who are you? Moses protested at this point, if I go to the people of Israel and tell them the God of your ancestors has sent me to you, they will ask me, well, what is his name? Then what should I tell them? How does God respond? He doesn't say, well, I'm the big bearded man in the sky, you know, who's really ripped for an old guy, and who's surrounded by naked kids for some reason. I'm all for Michelangelo, but this is a very disturbing picture when you think about it. This is the American folk religion picture of God. He's the big guy in the sky. You ever hear people say that? Yeah, the big guy. Richard Dawkins, the famous atheist, the sky daddy, yeah, as he says. The invisible man in the sky. That's not God. Instead, God says to Moses, who am I? I am who I am. This is what you're going to say to the Israelites, Moses. I am has sent me to you. Moses must have said, deep. What does it mean? I am who I am. Of course, this is in the first person. In the third person, for us to speak of God, we would call him Yahweh, the God who is. But he's saying, I am. This could mean, I am the one who has always existed. I am who I am. I am in the present tense, the ongoing tense. I've always existed. I always will exist. And I'm here with you right now. He has the property of self-existence, or as the older philosophers used to put it, a seity. Ah, the Latin meaning from, and say meaning self. Where is God? He's from self. So that whole ignorant question of who created God is a bunch of nonsense when you know the definition of God. What's the explanation for the self-existent being? He's self-existent. He comes from himself. He's always existed. He always will exist. And let me add, while I'm at it, if nothing in reality has the property of self-existence, nothing would exist. We would be borrowing existence from previous antecedent causes going back in an infinite regress until we reach a point of what? Someone or something with self-existence. That being is God. God is that being. This term, I am, could also mean I'm the one who intervenes. Read the book of Ezekiel sometime, and you'll read over and over. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. Then they will know that I am Yahweh. I'm going to come in, I'm going to do that, and then they will know I am Yahweh. What's the implication? The implication is this, that when God wants to reveal himself, he acts in history. He moves. Not just that I've always been and I always will be, but I'm going to move into history. Also, I'm the one who keeps his promises. God introduces his covenant. Have you ever noticed whenever you see God introduce a promise or a covenant, a contract, he always says, I am Yahweh. And then he gives the contract to the people. So I'm the one who's always been, the always will be. I'm the one who will intervene and act on your behalf. And I'm the one who keeps his promise. That's who you're going to say is coming to meet with you. The great and powerful I am. And at this point, God explains his plan to Moses from start to finish. The only problem is Moses doesn't believe him. So he starts with a third excuse. No one's going to believe me, Lord. He says in chapter 4, what if they don't believe me? Or they listen to me and they say, the Lord did not appear to you. Wait a minute. In chapter 3, verse 18, God had just said, the elders of Israel will listen to you. And yet, what's God's response? Did I stutter when I said that? Is that what God says here? Or does he say, you know, just tell them to have faith, will you? You know, just have a leap of faith, blind faith. Huh? He doesn't do that. Instead, God says to Moses, what's in your hand? A shepherd's staff. That's what I carry every day. Huh. The Lord said, throw it on the ground. So Moses is like, do you remember the question? Throw it on the ground. Okay, yeah, sure. He throws it on the ground. And after he does this, it became a snake. And Moses ran from it. Yeah, we laugh, but man, if you saw a snake, you'd probably run too, you know what I mean? Then the Lord said to him, reach out your hand and take it by the tail. So Moses reached out and held the snake by the tail, but then it turned right back into the staff. That's what we call a miracle. Why is this the sign that he's going to give? Because the pharaohs at the time had a urei, a cobra snake, sticking out of the top of their little helmet that they used to wear. This was kind of like the team mascot. It was showing the power of the Egyptian dynasty. King Tut look up the photos, had a picture of a snake sticking right out of his forehead, and Moses shows up with a snake. We're going to learn later that his snake eats the other snakes. My snake is bigger than your snake, is what he's saying. This said the Lord is so that they may believe that the Lord has appeared to you. Then he said, put your hand inside your cloak. So Moses put his hand inside the cloak, and when he took it out, the skin was leprous. He's like, how's this supposed to help anything? So then God said, put it back into the cloak. And he put it back in the cloak, and when he took it back out, it was restored. It went from leprous right back to his regular skin. Leprosy. So first it was showing I have power over the Egyptian dynasty. Now it's showing I've got the power over disease and death. The scariest disease at the time was leprosy. And he's saying, I've got power over that. Finally, number three says, if they don't believe with these first two signs or listen to you, take some water from the Nile River and pour it out on the ground. The water you take from the river will become blood on the ground. Again, why water from the Nile? Because they believed that the Nile River was a god. More on this in chapter 7 through 10. That God is going to move in such a way that he's going to take down this god man, Pharaoh, who believed he was the son of a god. That is to say, that his mother had sex with a god and that he was the offspring of that god. He's going to take down that power and publicly humiliate Pharaoh. He was going to take down the view of the control of death that Pharaoh had over the people. And he was going to take down the gods of Egypt to show them impotent and inept and false. Well, Moses says, I don't talk good. His fourth excuse, he says to God, pardon your servant, Lord. I've never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you've spoken to your servant. I'm slow of speech and tongue. Some people say Moses had a speech impediment. Don't you believe it for a second. I don't buy it. Oh, he had a speech impediment. That's his problem. No, that's not true. Stephen says Moses was a man of power in words and in deeds. You know who came up with this whole idea that Moses was slow of speech, literally in Hebrew, that he had a heavy tongue? Moses! Moses came up with that excuse. This is coming from a man who's morbidly insecure and doing anything he can to get out. Maybe he had something, but if he did, it's vastly exaggerated, unbelievably exaggerated. No, he was a good speaker. There's nothing in the rest of the Pentateuch where Moses is having a hard time speaking. How does God respond to this? Well, practice makes perfect, buddy. You just have to keep trying. Nothing like that. Instead, he says, who gave human beings their mouths? Who makes them deaf or mute? Who gives them sight or makes them blind? Is it not I, the Lord? You see what he's saying? Oh, you've got trouble speaking, huh? What if you were deaf? What if you were mute? You couldn't speak at all. What if you were blind? You don't think I have power over all of that? Is that what you're saying to me? Who made your mouth? Now, go. I'm going to help you to speak. I'm going to teach you what to say. Don't worry about that. You think I'm going to abandon you now? Well, at this point, Moses has exhausted his excuses. And finally, he just says, no. Pardon your servant, Lord, he says. Please, please send someone else. All these excuses, what were they? They were the matador's cape. They were the smokescreen. Oh, I've got all these problems. I got all these insecurities. It really sounds like Moses is being humble, doesn't it? I'm just not that good of a speaker. Who am I to do this? I don't know what to say. Really, this wasn't Moses doubting himself. What was it? It was him doubting God. And so how does God respond to this final statement? You know, up until this point, he's been very patient. Oh, you got an objection? Let me help you with that. You got that excuse? Let me help you with that. At this point, he just flat out says, no. We read in verse 14, the Lord's anger burned against Moses. However, even in God's anger, we see God's grace. God says to him, well, what about your brother, Aaron, the Levite? I know he's a good speaker. He's already on his way to meet you. So this whole thing, he's having this whole conversation, and the whole time he knew Aaron was on the way to be there, and he set this whole thing up knowing Moses would say no. He'll be glad to see you. In other words, what's he saying here? He's saying, Moses, I know you're incompetent. I know you're inept. I know you're insecure. I know you got baggage. I know you're a sinner. But I'm going to be with you, and I'm going to put you on a team with your brother. I'm going to give you a team to help you with the areas in which you have faults and problems, and you're going to help Aaron as well. He says, but take this staff in your hand so you can perform the signs with it. So we read in verse 18, Moses thought to himself, well, I guess I got to put in my 2-week notice. He went back to Jethro, his father-in-law, and he said, let me return to my own people in Egypt to see if any of them are still alive. And Jethro said, go, wish you well. Now the Lord had said to Moses in Midian, go back to Egypt, for all those who wanted to kill you, they're dead. There's a new administration, so don't worry about that. So Moses took his wife and sons, put them on a donkey, and started back to Egypt. And he took the staff of God in his hand. What are we to learn here? What are the lessons from God's interaction with Moses? If you're reading this, what can you pick up from the way that God deals with this abject failure like Moses? Well, for one, we see very abundantly and clearly that God never tries to convince Moses that he's a gifted or a competent man. We don't see a word about that. We don't see Moses saying, who am I? And he says, oh, you're so gifted and charming and wonderful. None of that. The focus is not on Moses whatsoever. So someone recovering from failure, it seems to me, needs to get the focus off of their problems and get the focus onto God. That would be the key lesson. We see, too, that God was moving on a totally different timeline than Moses. God seems like he was in no rush. Right in the prime of his life, the age of 40, Moses is ready to move. God says, I'm not ready. We got another 40 years. My God, why? Why would you do that? Well, I'm going to have you go out into the Sinai Peninsula and into Saudi Arabia, and you're going to learn all of the different wadis and the wells and the topography. You're going to know how to bring a bunch of sheep around there. You're going to learn all that territory because let me tell you, you're going to spend a lot of time out there and it's not going to be with sheep in the future. It's going to be with people. And you know, Moses, during this time, I'm going to teach you how to deal with criticism of which you will have much once you become a leader of the Israelite nation. And I'm going to teach you humility, Moses. You weren't ready when you were 40. As a brash and brazen, you know, son of the Pharaoh. You'll only be ready when you've spent 40 years being broken down in humility out in the desert. It's going to get to the point, Moses, in Numbers chapter 12, verse 3, that it will be written that you are the most humble man who's ever lived. I'm forming you over the next 40 years. That's what I'm doing. God was patient with his doubts, wasn't he? He's patient with yours, too. Very patient, very kind, willing to give answers, willing to encourage. Yet there's a certain point at which God draws the line and he says, this is no longer intellectual. This is no longer emotional. This is spiritual and this is moral. There's a certain point where you've stopped wrestling with God over the answers and you've started to just outright refuse God. And that is where we cross the threshold from doubt to unbelief. Not just that I'm getting answers and I'm wrestling with those answers, but that I'm actually getting answers and I'm refusing them. Well, God is pretty gracious with Moses, and we're going to see him pick up this man, shake him off, and turn him into a whole new person. Second and finally, what do we learn about Moses' interactions with God? For one, we saw that Moses allowed a single comment to control his life for how long? I don't know if anyone in this room has had a person's derisive, cutting comment control their life for 4 decades. However, you could be sitting here in your mind, you're thinking to yourself, I am still being controlled by what that person said years ago. This is so bad that Moses constructs this entire matrix and web of excuses. And to be sure, they're very plausible. You know what I mean? Like, he's saying, who am I? I'm not able to do this. And what am I supposed to say? And I'm not a good speaker. I don't speak well. And I'm too old. And he is immoral. He is incompetent. God knows all that. That's not the point. Here's Moses' problem. He's so focused on his problems that even God himself couldn't convince him to the contrary. Let that sink in for a moment into your heart. He was so focused on his own sin and problems and incompetence and comparison and perform and what people are saying about him and thinking about him that even the words of God couldn't convince him to the contrary. He was just hamstrung with insecurity. Why? Because he was too focused on himself. In those 40 years, he let this turn into a sickness which metastasized throughout his entire mind, and it needed an intervention of God himself to come into his life and to break through and to release Moses from his own personal slavery. Even though Moses was 40 years old and then he was 80 years old, his story was not over. Could you imagine anybody here saying to yourself, I'm 40 and I'm going to try and start to follow God at the age of 40? 40 is old. 38, very young. 40, but 80? 80 years old and that's when he begins to serve God at the age of 80? Oh yeah. So if you're sitting here tonight and you're saying to yourself, I've wasted so much time. What am I doing here? Year after year, I don't feel like I've gotten anything accomplished. How long did it take before God was ready to start to move in Moses' life? There isn't anybody here who's waited for 80 years. And yet that's precisely what we see with Moses to the point where in the end of the Pentateuch, the final chapter, we read of Moses, there has never been another prophet in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. Your story is not over. It is not over. You have many years ahead of you, many years where God is going to use you. The question is, are you going to double down in this unbelief, in this strategy of excuses and pointing the finger, self-abasement? Or are you finally, is tonight going to be the night where you finally turn and say, God, I'm going to do it your way. I'm going to trust what you say is true. I believe your words more than my feelings. And God, I guarantee this. God will change your life. Might not be on your timetable. It wasn't with Moses. It might not be the way that you want it to be, your plan. It wasn't with Moses. But he will change your life and he will make an impact for eternity for the cause of Christ.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.